Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And we have a very exciting episode in store where we're going to be talking about GLP-1 receptor agonist and type 1 diabetes. But to do so, we have a very special guest, Dr. Viral Shah, joining us today. So, Dr. Shah, do you mind just introducing yourself to our audience and telling us a little bit about your practice and research?
Yeah, sure. And thanks for having me, Diana and Natalie. So I am Dr. Viral Shah. I'm a professor in medicine division of endocrinology here at Indiana University. And I also direct a diabetes clinical research program at the IU Center for Diabetes and Metabolic Diseases at Indiana University. And my research focuses on newer therapeutics and technologies. How can we make the lives of people with diabetes much better and improving glycemic control? That's what I do. So again, glad to be here in this podcast and happy to dive deep into GLP-1 use in people with type 1 diabetes.
Excellent. Well, welcome. So just recently, within the last couple of weeks, you and your group published a new study titled Efficacy and Safety of Tirzepatide in Adults with Type 1 Diabetes, a Proof of Concept Observational Study. We have been looking at GLP-1 since Victoza was approved way back in 2010 in type 1s. Can you tell us a little bit more about this study and what it brings to the table of this di continued discussion?
Yeah, a great question. And I think we all know that, let's say, the best available modality of managing type 1 diabetes is an AID system, automated insulin delivery system. You can call artificial pancreas, a layman term. Even with that use, only about 50 to 55% of individuals with type 1 are able to achieve an A1C of less than 7, which is considered as an optimal recommended target by most societies and organizations, right? Why? And there are multiple reasons for that, right? One of the reasons is that the prevalence of obesity and overweight is increasing in people with type 1 diabetes. These people require a lot of insulin. That insulin resistance leads to more postprandial excursion and not having a good glycemic control. So we are looking for some adjunctive therapies for a long time, as you mentioned, Natalie, right? Since liraglutide time, that people have tried metformin, people have tried DPP-4, GLP-1, older generation, that's a liraglutide. Unfortunately, none of these medications are approved. And I wish that the newer generation GLP-1, which has a really good potential to reduce weight, reduce the insulin requirement in people with type 1 diabetes, and that will lead to an optimization of glycemic control. And not only that, all this research in type 2 diabetes and obesity space, we know that these drugs are great in reducing cardiovascular outcomes, right? And so or cardiovascular adverse outcomes in a better way. And so why can't we utilize this therapy in type 1 diabetes? So this study, with that kind of a background, we just wanted to have a proof of concept. And the proof of concept is to ignite the communities and the industry to do something in this space.
Wow.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, if you don't mind sharing a little bit the background of kind of the study population and ultimately what you guys did find when you studied it.
And so we all know, and I think you covered that in a diabetes dialogue in the past, that with certain celebrity tweets, the GLP-1 became very popular, not only in diabetes, but even in people without diabetes. And so when the tirzepatide got approved for management of type 2 diabetes in early 2022, we thought that we're going to get a lot of questions from people with type 1 diabetes as well. So we started creating a registry of people that may be receiving a prescription of tirzepatide for a clinical indication. Now, again, we all know that that it's an off-label in type 1 at this moment, but we all do prescriptions and off-label management of, you know, type 1 with other therapies. So in this study, we followed those 26 individuals who were prescribed tirzepatide for some clinical indication. And we don't know that indication because it's an observational study that we didn't contact this individual. We just followed them silently looking at the EMR over 8 months. And what we found, so primary outcome of this study was, as usual, reduction in the A1C and then reduction in the percentage of body weight compared to the baseline. And there were a bunch of secondary outcomes that were related to the CGM matrix. So in a primary outcome, the A1C reduction was almost 0.6%. Now remember that the mean A1C at the baseline was 7.3. So these are not individuals who had an A1C of 9, right? So 7.3 and still more than half a point reduction in the A1C is remarkable. And in the line of that expectation, because that A1C went down, then TIR, A1C, TITR, that's a time in tight range, are all kind of a similar matrix in one or other way. So time in range improved by about 12%, time in tight range improved in a similar way by about 11%. So all good in terms of the glycemic control. The weight-wise, the weight reduction was about 10% compared to the baseline. That's excellent, right? We consider more than 7% as like really good weight loss for cardiovascular and other outcomes. So 10% weight loss is a great weight loss. And all this achieved with the use of tirzepatide in people with type 1 diabetes without increasing time below range. So we always have a concern when we use the adjunctive therapies in type 1 is that what if it will increase the risk for hypoglycemia? And there was no increase in time below range. And if you look at the rate of severe hypoglycemia, which one individual in this trial, which is very equivalent to what we know from a T1D exchange registry. So it's not that different in tirzepatide group compared to what we know on a background information. So I think in summary, tirzepatide, I think again, this is take that with a lot of grain of salt. It's a feasibility study. It's a, something that we just wanted to know what happens that can probably help us to design a better clinical trial in future. But in this proof of concept study, tirzepatide leads to a great reduction in the A1C, improvement in time in range without increasing time below range, and also a good weight loss with this agent.
That's incredible. I mean, I just, when we read, when the study was, you know, published a handful of days ago now, the first thing I did was text Diana, we got to talk to him. Let's do this, right? And I think that the other thing we need to consider is we assume because the cardiovascular risk reduction it with type twos, we all just sort of say, well, you need this with type ones as well. How do you feel about it? Do you feel the same way we have to believe that this will help the people with type one as well in a cardiovascular way, the GLP ones in general. Right? We have to believe that even without the weight reduction, we see some cardiovascular risk reduction.
Yeah. And again, this is going to be a hypothesis because we do not have Absolutely. Any trial in this space. But I think my line of thinking is very much similar to yours. We know that semaglutide trial, even in people without diabetes and obesity, has shown improvement in cardiovascular outcomes, right? So we have a strong data in type 2 diabetes. We have a pretty strong data in people without diabetes and obesity. Why can't that be translated in type 1? I can't think of any reasons that why it should not. But at the same time, we all know that in a science, what we need is an evidence. And for an evidence-based science, I think this is a right platform for me to say that all the industry should think about. That includes the Eli Lilly and the Novo Nordisk because these are the two major manufacturers of GLP-1. Do something about thinking of, you know, phase 2 or phase 3 clinical trial in a type 1 diabetes. I think our type 1 community needs an adjunct therapy to help not just their glycemic, but the glycemic and metabolic, control. Insulin alone is not enough in this space, right? So.
Yeah, I completely agree. So I know this was a small study, but I'm curious if you noticed any differences between people that were on like AID systems as opposed to on MDI compared to, I guess, their effects of the tirzepatide.
That's a great question. So to be honest, we are currently analyzing the data separately on people who use the AID system versus who did not in this. Again, the study was done at the Barbara Davis Center, measured the patients were using CGM and AID in practice. And so I'm not surprised that majority of this were AID users. The MDI group was very small compared to the AID. The data that we are hoping to present at the American Diabetes Association meeting, so we submitted an abstract waiting for the confirmation to present the data. But the teaser here is that what you saw here in this result, it's pretty much the similar, whether it's an AID system or no AID system.
Wow.
So this drug could be useful in everybody with type 1, regardless of their insulin delivery system.
I have one more question. So I know, you know, we talked in the beginning about liraglutide and how that was studied. I remember, I mean, though, and those were larger randomized controlled trials, but I remember one of the concerns was there was increased ketosis. Did you guys, I mean, I know this is observational, but any reports of increased ketosis with tirzepatide?
I am glad that you asked this question. And I think that So ketosis, with now even low carb diet that has become very popular in type 1 and type 2 diabetes, you would find a ketosis if you have these people check their ketone levels every day in a higher prevalence, right? And mild ketosis is not detrimental to overall health or type 1 diabetes in any way, right? So I think one of the things in liraglutide, because it was a large randomized controlled trial, and I'm sure the regulator wanted to have ketones to be included as a part of this. It's a safety thing, nothing wrong about that part. But when people are testing that multiple times, you're gonna find some mild ketosis. And the most common adverse event of GLP-1, which is kind of an effect adverse event, is the nausea and vomiting, right? More so nausea than vomiting, but so if the people are having a nausea or rarely they throw up and eating less, you are going to find mild ketosis. But then the question is that they are not clinically relevant. And so what is more clinically relevant is the DKA. Someone
right.
Having a severely high ketosis leading to an hospitalization. And we have not observed a single DKA over 8 months since this 26 individuals. Now, again, preliminary data, but I think it gives an initial signal that I think I'm not worried about. And even though if you look at the liraglutide and adjunct 2 trial, the DKA event were not that different between groups. It was just the mild ketosis that were higher in the liraglutide group. So I think I'm not super concerned about ketosis with the use of GLP-1 analogs.
And I think that brings us to that another point that, you know, not only did it demonstrate relative safety, that only 2 patients discontinued the medication. People stay on it. You know, we talk about the side effects. It is not, you know, we have lots of people have side effects in the very beginning, but they get used to them and they like the drug so much that they say, no, a week or two of a little bit of nausea or a little bit of GI distress did not make it that I wanted to stop this, because at the first injection, they see improvement in glycemia.
Yeah, again, I think everything that we do in a clinical practice that does have a benefits and risk, right? And you weigh that benefit over risk. And so mild risk, but a larger benefit, that's what is suggested by the patient preference, right? So they are willing to take a little bit of risk of a nausea or some GI adverse events compared to that larger benefit that they are gaining. So people are not discontinuing this drug despite they do have some minor GI side effects. And that's what we saw in this trial too, that only two people say that, okay, I cannot tolerate that, but rest everybody continued that.
This is amazing. I mean, I really love it because it's yet another, we need to add to the treatment to with type one. It is almost impossible to do on its own with just insulin, even with AID. And we've proven that again and again. Now the next step is, of course, one, are you going to continue to follow these patients?
The answer is no.
Okay.
So when we did this, because our intention initially to really collect clean data as much as possible. And so these are like a prospectively collected CGM data over 8 months. And I think that the results will not be that different if I go beyond 8 months to 9 months to 10 months to 12 months. So that's number one reason that I don't think that it's going to change the science. And number two is that I think it's a need to now push for a randomized trial rather than generating some data from a real world, which is good, that can help you to, you know, formulate the hypothesis. But I think I am pushing towards more that we should push the industry to really think about our people with type 1 diabetes. These drugs are really helpful to them. We need a randomized trial.
Definitely. Well, we want to thank you so much for your time today and this really important research that you've shared with us. And we want to thank our viewers for tuning in. And that concludes this episode of Diabetes Dialogue.
Thanks for having me.